Hey friend, welcome to Girls Night, where we work through life's biggest decisions and transitions together. I'm your host, Stephanie Mae Wilson, and I am so glad you're here. Let's get started. Today we're talking about how to know if it's time for us to stay or time for us to go. I love this topic because if you're anything like me, this is a question you've come to over and over again throughout your life. Should you stay in the relationship or is it time to go? What about the job? What about your hometown? What about this new opportunity you didn't see coming, but now you can't stop thinking about? These moments are so intimidating because in a lot of ways, it feels like the fate of our future hangs in the balance. It feels like with this one little decision, we could ruin everything. Or maybe that's just me. Now, I couldn't think of a better person to walk us through this than my dear friend, Emily P. Freeman. Emily is someone I have looked up to for years and years and years. She's an author, podcaster, spiritual director, and workshop leader. Her most important work, as she defines it, is helping to create soul space and offering spiritual companionship and discernment for anyone struggling with decision fatigue. She recently wrote a new book called How to Walk Into a Room, The Art of Knowing When to Stay and When to Walk Away. And that's what we're talking about today. In this episode, Emily is teaching us what caution flags to look for when we feel like it might be time to make a change, how to know the difference between readiness and timeliness, how to move forward after leaving something behind, why the right decision doesn't always feel comfortable, and so much more. This conversation felt like the biggest hug. It was truly so encouraging. So grab your coziest blanket and your favorite notebook, and let's dive in. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. As many of you know, I recently wrote a book, and while it was the most rewarding project of my career so far, it also came with a lot of hard work and long nights. And sometimes when things started to feel a little bit overwhelming, I needed to get a few things off my chest so I could clear my mind and keep the writing process flowing. And the thing that helped me so much to sort through those feelings was therapy. Now tell me if any of this sounds familiar. Maybe you're going through something really hard right now, a big loss or a gigantic life transition. Maybe you frequently feel anxious, depressed, overwhelmed, or just generally discouraged. Maybe you really, really, really want your life circumstances to change, but you don't know how to actually change them. Or maybe you're feeling stuck as you try to work through your past, navigate your present, or figure out your future. Friend, if you can relate to any of this, you're not alone. I've been there, and therapy has been the thing that has helped me more than anything else with all of this. In the last 10 years or so, I've learned that strength isn't proving I can do it on my own. It's knowing that I don't have to. I'm at my strongest when I have a full support system around me, and an essential part of my support system is therapy. Therapy can be absolutely life-changing. That is, if you can afford it and find a therapist you like and trust. But of course, this is easier said than done. And that's why I'm so excited to be partnering with this week's podcast sponsor. Our sponsor for today's episode is BetterHelp. BetterHelp is the easiest and most affordable way I've ever found to find a great therapist. It's entirely online and super easy to sign up. You can get started right away. And if you don't love the counselor you're paired with, switching is easy and it's free. If you're going through something hard in your relationships, or if you're in a funk you just can't shake, if you've been feeling anxious or depressed lately, or if you're feeling stressed and you need help balancing your everyday life and schedule, BetterHelp is an incredible resource for you. And I'm so thankful that they've given me a promo code that I can share with you to make it even easier to get started. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/friendship today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/friendship. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. Friends, springtime is finally here, but that also means allergy season is in full swing. I have always struggled with allergies, and I don't know about you, but I am especially allergic to cats. More on that in a second. Well, luckily for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better. This double-action combination of prescription-strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. The time that I use Claritin the absolute most is when I'm at my parents' house, my childhood home. They have this absolutely beautiful cat that they love and I like, except for the fact that he sheds so much. So that means that I'm basically sneezing from the second I arrive home to the second I leave, unless I take Claritin. My dad has even started having it ready for me right when I walk in the door. Are you ready to live life as though you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed. Claritin, thank you so much for sponsoring our girls' night. We love having you. Friends, I am just absolutely thrilled for who we have back on the show today. I'm sitting here with my friend, Emily P. Freeman. Emily, welcome back to Girls' Night.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Emily, you are one of my favorite people. You have been for more than 10 years. I've been reading your work for ages. I've been listening to your podcast for ages. I've just been a massive fan of yours. And so anytime I get to talk to you, I'm just so happy about it. For women who haven't gotten to meet you yet, like the two of them who haven't, tell us who you are, what you do, and I'd love to hear a fun fact about you.
Well, I live in North Carolina with my family. So I have my husband John and I have been married for 22 years, I think. That feels right. We have twins who are sophomores in college, and we have a son who is a junior in high school. So we have one left at home. And that, you know, that's parenting is fun. It's fun. I've learned so much about myself. And not all of it great during the parenting years. But that's sort of our home life. And, you know, like I said, we've lived in North Carolina all of our married life. I came here for college. Fun fact I'll say in the middle of this is I came to North Carolina for college to study sign language interpreting. And so I thought that I would be an ASL interpreter as my career. That was my plan. And that didn't turn out that way. I did do that for a while, got nationally certified, did the thing in the school system, and then I K-12, and then I did college level interpreting, worked at the university, and really, really loved educational interpreting. But then when I became pregnant with two children at one time, just decided that, you know, that might be the end of the road for a time for interpreting for me. And then I just kind of never picked it back up. But I do love the language and the deaf community. And every now and then I'll have an opportunity to use it. There's a deaf woman who works at the Target, our local Target. And sometimes it's really fun to kind of go to her line and chat it up with her. But that's about the extent of my sign language practice these days. But the work that I do, you know, in some ways that's relevant because I was a trained listener as a sign language interpreter. It was my job to interpret from one language into another. And while I don't do my work in that way anymore, I do still think a lot of those skills I learned as a sign language interpreter are transferable to the work that I do now as a writer, even as a podcaster, and as maybe most specifically as a spiritual director, where I'm so glad to be able to hold space for people as they discern what God is up to in their lives. And I'm sort of a glad witness to that, helping to hold that space, to ask some curious questions, and to, in many ways, listen. But also, I've had to unlearn some of the toxic ways that we often tend to listen in our relationships with other people. And so that's a real gift as a part of my work. So, but like I said, I host a podcast called The Next Right Thing. I've written 6 books at this point. So I've been doing this writing work for, oh goodness, I don't know, 15, 17 years now, which feels crazy, but here we are, my dear. Thank you so much for asking and for having me here.
Mm. Oh man, I love that. I love knowing that about you. Do you know that I have twins?
You know what? I feel like in the recesses of my mind, I might have known. How old are your twins?
3.
Oh, they're 3.
Yep. They're 3. It is. It is. You are here to tell the tale. You are on the other side.
We made it.
You made it.
Let me tell you, a real moment was when they turned 18 and their voter registration cards came in the mail. For me, a moment for me as a mom, because I was like, oh, the United States government recognizes that they are grown humans. Now, are they fully grown? I mean, they'll always be my children. Mm-hmm. But like the fact that there was an entity that recognized, like, and here's your voter card because you're 18. It was like a real moment of accomplishment for me as a parent.
Every time they have a birthday, I go, thank you, thank you, thank you. Like it's, I mean, I feel like I'm accepting an award. Like
right, it feels that way.
Yeah, it really does. I feel like I don't give them enough credit. They are so wonderful, like 75% of the time. And then like 25% of the time, they're totally the what you picture 3-year-old twins being, which is just like chaos and lots of opinions. Okay, so you, 6 books, right? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
So you're about to come out with number 7, right?
Well, this is my
number 6.
Okay, this is number 6. I was including it, Stephanie.
I was, because it's done and it's ready to be out in the world. Yes, it absolutely counts. I love the concept of this book. And I love the title. So it's called How to Walk into a Room, The Art of Knowing When to Stay and When to Walk Away. Mm, love it so much. Tell us about this book.
Well, you know, The Next Right Thing is my last book and it came out in 2019. And that was sort of a broad book about, you know, soulful ways to make life decisions and sort of some really simple things we can do right now to help us make daily decisions of life, hard ones, easy ones, in between ones. And I love that conversation. But what I found as I had that conversation both with the podcast and with the book is that the decisions that seem to be the most difficult, trying, to cause us the most trouble were the ones that were connected with spaces that we were in, whether that be a physical space, like a workroom, a classroom, or a home, a relationship also could be an ideological space, like a political party, a faith community, or even just a personal belief system, that when we began to question those spaces, a lot of us feel really lost and we feel like there's no path and there's no one to tell us or to help us to know which way to go. And so that's a conversation I've become deeply invested in. I have found that we often just want to know, like, what should I do and how do I know I'm not going to wreck it all up? And especially when we're making those decisions, it's hard enough to make those types of decisions when you have all of your support systems intact. But what if you start to question your support systems? Then what do you do? And so that's kind of the conversation that I wanted to have, submitting that if life is like a house, then every room of our life tells a story and it holds a story. And we know that some of those rooms are for us. This is my room. I belong here. It's a great room for me for now. And then other rooms will step in for a second and we're like, nope, not my space. And that's those are the quote unquote easy decisions to make. But I think the tricky part, what we've already kind of said, is that what do we do when those rooms that maybe were one time for us are not for us anymore? And how do we navigate the sense of a loss of belonging and the sense of maybe it's a place we want to stay in, but someone else is saying it's time for us to go. You know, this happens all the time. We should all have master's degrees in staying and leaving because we've been doing it our whole lives. But the reality is that we've been doing it imperfectly our whole lives. We've been doing it sloppily. We've been stumbling forward. And so I thought it was, at least for me, I wanted to spend and really sit on and spend more time with what does it look like to walk into a room And how does the last room we left inform that?
This is so beautiful. This is so beautiful. And I tell you this every time I get to talk to you, but the way that you move through the world and the words that you use to describe the world and the space that you leave and just even like your tone feels like it opens up a space for my soul to breathe, which is totally something you've been talking about forever. And I just love that about you. And so even now I'm like, oh, okay. Like, thank you for seeing us. Thank you for seeing us in you know, whatever this looks like for us and giving us some space. So I want to know, like, what is the first, when you are, whether the space you're in is a, like, you know, community or relationship or affiliation, what are some of the first hints that it might be time to leave a room?
I think we all know what it feels like to, we know what those hints feel like. We experience them in our bodies. We experience them sometimes as anxiety or as frustration or even as sadness, but we don't always know to connect the dots. And so I would say that the first movement, once you start to just begin to have that hint, like, I wonder, like, you're probably listening right now, someone's listening and thinking, I've been wondering for a while now if it might be time for me to move on from this space for whatever reason. And if that's you, I would say the first movement is not to decide yes or no, is it time? There's a lot of steps in between. And it starts with a practice that I call pointing and calling. And this is not something I came up with. This is a practice that the Japanese rail workers actually do. It's a safety system for the trains in Japan. And they implemented it so that it would be a safer system for travelers and even for the workers. And it worked. And what it is it's very simple. And it almost sounds like something that your toddler twins could do, which is when a train comes into the station, the railway workers will simply point and call. They'll point at the time and then they'll call it out loud, 1201. And then they'll point at the speed that the train was traveling and they'll call it out loud so that everyone can hear. And they do this at different, there's different checkpoints, there's different ways and things that they repeat, they point and they call. James Clear talks about this practice in his book, Atomic Habits, as well as a way to kind of build habits that we are, you know, as we kind of point and call and just really obvious ways, almost like this feels too simple. But it can be a way of beginning to build habits in our own life. And so I would say this practice, when applied to our inner life and the rooms of our life, can help us to know what is actually true right now. And I like to do this using some questions. And one of the questions that I think is important to ask ourselves when we begin to either question a room or begin to realize there's a room that we're in that's questioning us is we can begin to name what are the caution flags in this room? And what I mean by that is some of us, when we sense something is off, we immediately run to red flag territory. Like something's off, wave the red flag. Others of us might sense something's off and we're like, no, it's nothing. Green flag all the way. And then sometimes we sense like a tiny, tiny, tiny red flag and we want to ignore it. We're not sure what to do with it. But years ago, my friend Holly Good said something to me I've never forgotten. She said, tiny red flags never shrink or rarely shrink. They only grow. And that has been so helpful for me to begin to trust that tiny, tiny place inside me that says something's off here. But just that is that every hesitation, worry, fear, or something being off does not necessarily mean it's time for you to get out. But what it does mean is it's time to enter into a discernment process. It's time to begin to assess where I am, to point and call, what about this room is lovely? And what about this room is difficult for me? Who is missing from this room? Who has recently left? Who is on their way in? What's at stake if I leave? And what's at stake if I don't? And some of these questions are just, they're not necessarily going to tell you what to do ultimately, but they do begin to paint a picture for us of what is actually happening in this space beyond just kind of what I feel like might be happening in my own body. In a way, I like to think of it as we're beginning to turn on the lights in the room and to see not just the sofa that we're sitting on or the people right in front of us, but also what's happening in the corners. And in the process of how to walk into a room, the actual book, I like to think of it as a slow revealing of what's happening in the room. Because man, someone comes in and turns on the light, it can be jarring. So we try to do this. I want to, you know, embody doing this together, taking it slow and being kind to ourselves along the way.
Yeah. I like the idea of that. The fact that red flags don't, or tiny red flags don't shrink, they only grow, because it's almost like you don't need to know right away if this is like going to be a giant red flag. Like it'll tell you. You know, like just give it a little bit of time. If this is a thing, you'll know. I love all of that. You know, one of the things, the hesitations that's coming up for me immediately is, and this might just be my personality, or this might be, you know, my Enneagram 2-ness, or like, you know, this, whatever. I feel like the only answer all the time for me is to stay. Like, it feels like unkind. It feels disloyal. It feels wrong. It feels, it is hard for me. I know with my head, in my heart, in my soul, it feels like there's never a moment where the answer is to like give up on someone or on a group of people. Can you kind of talk me through that?
Well, you stated that beautifully, Stephanie. And what you're doing is you're unveiling some of the scripts you have about leaving. Oh. And we all have leaving scripts. We also have staying scripts. And they depend on, you mentioned an Enneagram number. Mm-hmm. It depends on your personality, your social location. It depends on your cultural upbringing. It depends on even whether you live in the city or country, whether you live near family or away. It could depend on what part of the world you live in. We all have narratives about what it means, positive, negative, or neutral, to stay and to leave. You mentioned leaving. One of your narratives is, if I leave, it means I'm giving up on someone. And I don't think it's right to give up on someone. And so the challenge that I would introduce, or maybe the invitation would be, is it possible to leave and also not be giving up on someone? Is there a world where it's possible to leave in such a way that there is gratitude, that there is a bridge built? Sometimes it's not possible, but sometimes it is. And if it were to be possible, what might that look like? And so in the same way that you have scripts about leaving and staying, so do all the people around you. Mm-hmm. And I would also say every room that we're in, Priya Parker talks about this in her book, The Art of Gathering, rooms come with scripts. So the room of, for example, the Catholic Church has a particular script that parishioners follow, as opposed to, since I'm speaking of a faith space, a more, let's say, like a Pentecostal church has a different type of script. They're both faith spaces. They follow very different scripts. And so their narratives of how they behave in the room, how they behave in community, are going to be different. And again, this is not better or worse. It's just different. And so the same goes for our own, all the other rooms of our lives, not just faith spaces, but our vocational spaces and our family spaces. And a lot of us, we follow these scripts because it keeps us safe. It doesn't rock the boat. Sometimes we love the script. And then there are some of us who have been going off script our whole lives, and it's gotten us into some trouble. But I think that's one thing to point and call at, is to recognize, what are my own narratives ingrained in me? And a lot of times we don't know what they are until we start talking about it, about leaving and staying, because it's not that a script needs to be changed or is bad, but wouldn't it be something if we could make our decisions about staying or leaving in partnership with the people who love us, in partnership with God, in partnership with who we most deeply are on the inside, rather than having a predetermined sort of ingrained script that we don't even know is there, determine all of our decisions for us because it's just quote unquote wrong or it would be bad. So I think that's something to begin to question and to just bring into the light.
Yeah. I love it. It's so I feel like I just need some time to sit on the idea that everyone in a room, if I'm thinking about leaving a room, everyone in the room has a different script about staying and leaving. And so like, it's just, it's wild and important for us to remember that our way of seeing things is not the only way of seeing something. And so if we behave in a certain way, we make a certain decision, that decision is going to be read differently, a little bit differently by every single person in that room. And so the way that like, even though something feels like, oh, I feel like this is so hurtful, half the people might not even read it that way.
That's right.
And yes, that's so like freeing. But then on the other hand, knowing that something that we do is going to be read by some people in a way, like say we, you know, we decide to leave a certain group, some people in that room are going to see that as a really hurtful act, are going to see that as abandonment, are going to see that as rejection or something. How do we move forward knowing that that's going to be the case?
What a beautiful, honest question. Two things come to mind. The first is you described the reality that in any given room, we all might have a shared experience in that room, but we do not have the same experience. And so recognizing that, well, they were there, or you heard the conversation, or we all agreed this together. It's like, did we though? Were we having the same conversation, or have we had this experience was shared? And that's why when I teach as a residency lecturer out at a college in Wichita, Kansas. And at the end of the week, we give the students surveys. Now, we all had a shared experience. So one might say like, well, all the surveys are going to come back exactly the same. And let me tell you what, my friend, they do not. They are not exactly the same because everyone had a shared experience, but they did not have the same experience. And it's all based on so many factors that we've already talked about. And so just recognizing that can in some ways, hopefully it can bring some peace because you realize like there's no way I can ever embody everyone's experience. So that means my only option is to embody my own and to do it honestly with empathy and compassion for that of others. So this is growing our ability to see the world and to know that the world that we see is not the only world that there is. But the second thing, and you asked, like, how do we move forward when we know that our thing, like our decision is going to impact someone else and it might be not in a good way. Mm-hmm. And part of this is if you do come to the place, a discerning place where you realize it is time for me to leave this room, if that is your reality, then there are some practices that we can engage. And one of them is to recognize that endings will come and go, but closure is a luxury. And so I think some part of what we hope closure means is that I could explain myself to everyone in the room, that everyone understands why I had to make the decision I made, that I was able to finish all the work I felt I had to do while I was there, and that I walk out, I wave goodbye, I leave my presence, and I close the door softly behind me like the end of a sitcom, like, you know, the last show in a series. And if you get an ending like that, and sometimes they do arrive, then I would say, enjoy it fully, make your toast and have your parties, because most endings don't happen that way. And there is something about taking the endings that we get, imperfect as they are, and learning to bless them as they are, and learning to know that I did the best I could with what I knew at the time. And knowing that 5 years from now, you might look back and say, man, I wish I could have done that differently. And there is a practice that we can engage of being our own friend, the way we'd be a friend to someone else, and coming alongside ourselves and saying, you know what, if you were who you are now back then, you're right, you probably would have done it differently. But you didn't have what you needed to do it that way. You only had what you needed to do it the way you did it. And so I think there is a lot of, Parker Palmer talks about holding the tension and the tension between kind of what we hope to be true and what actually is true. And a lot of growth can happen in that tension place. But there's also a lot of grief and maybe even some lament that has to happen, knowing that the reality is in most situations in life, we're really never going to close that gap. But I think we can find peace in the gap as we accept that there are going to be some stories that we aren't going to get to tell. And there are going to be some conversations that happen without us in the room, and we're never going to be able to set the story straight. Am I going to be okay, even though that's true? And for me, the answer is sometimes. But as I learn this rhythm of leaving rooms and finding new ones, I'm finding it does become easier, even though it can still be very sad and very difficult.
You know, there's a long discerning process where you're looking at the relationship, you're looking at the group, you're looking at the space, and you're going, okay, you know, I'm noticing what's happening here. I'm calling it for what it is. I'm giving it space to like develop, and like I'm not deciding like this is a red flag, I'm out, you know, too quickly. I'm not being rash about it. When do you decide, like, how do you know when that scale tips far enough that you're like, nope, this isn't, I guess, when do you decide to give up on it getting better?
Well, I think it depends. I think it's going to be different for everyone. And that's why this is a discernment process and not a formula. Because if it were a formula, then we could say if A plus B equals C, that's when it's time. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's a maddening answer, I realize. Mm-hmm. But I do think, and I know I can tell by your face, but I do think that there are hints along the way. There are questions to continue to ask yourself. And I think our bodies give us a lot of clues along the way. Mm-hmm. I also think that Beth Morse said it best. She said, it's better to leave when you're sad than when you're angry. Because if you wait until you're angry, you've waited too long. And I found that to be a really helpful arrow, rather, maybe not an answer, but it is an arrow of moving in a direction of, wow, if I'm really angry and I'm not in a place where I'm going to be able to stay here. Because listen, thank the Lord that there are times when we are called to stay in a space that in every way does not feel like a good space for us. A way that maybe we don't feel like we're flourishing, but there may be a time when you're actually invited to stay. And I think that that's a very unique invitation. And I would say the default sometimes, it depends on what your default is, whether or not you're going to be a chronic overstayer or a chronic quick leaver. Mm-hmm. And so I think probably most of us know, you've already kind of said, I'm probably more of a stayer. And so I think that's when you would need to be paying attention to the sadness and anger barometer of, yeah. You know, because it is sad to think about leaving a space. But also, once you get to that anger space, and listen, nothing wrong with anger, but it can be a nice arrow to know, like, maybe my time here is coming to an end, because maybe I'm not really moving from a generous or a generative space anymore. And what might it mean for me to take steps in the direction of a change?
Yeah. Well, and I feel like if you wait until you're angry, you're going to like blow something up on the way out.
That you might regret later.
Yeah. Yeah. You kind of started to talk about this a little bit, but how do we discern the difference between like peace and what you call discomfort avoidance?
Well, growing up in faith spaces, I heard the phrase a lot when it came to making decisions. People would say, well, I didn't want to do that because I just didn't have a peace about it. I didn't have a peace. And I've probably said that in my life, to be honest, but I grew up and that was a really normal, frequent phrase. And the way I interpreted that phrase, maybe other people didn't mean this, but the way I interpreted it was that decision, that movement, that whatever it was, led to discomfort in my body, in my mind, in my heart. Therefore, I had no peace, which meant it must be wrong. That's how I interpret that statement. And that might be true. But I would say it's not always true. And that just because we feel some discomfort does not automatically mean there is no peace. And so I know there is a difference between true peace that comes from a place of alignment and wholeheartedness, the shalom kind of peace that the Bible talks about, and just wanting to be comfortable and not feel this on fire on the inside feeling. I'll tell you, some of the times when I have done the most deeply right thing, I have felt the most profound discomfort.
I'm laughing because I've written about this a couple times because I've always been so perplexed by this exact same thing, and I've never heard anyone talk about it. Because it's such a common thing to say, like, well, I just don't have peace about that, or do you feel peace about this or whatever? I don't think any of the good decisions, like, I think I'm prone to fear and discomfort or something, but like anytime I've ever done anything good, I am always a wreck over it. And I just like, I can think of a couple times where I'm like, nope, yeah, I shut that door and I went, I knew that that's what I was supposed to do. And it's usually, honestly, leaving a room. It's usually when I leave a room, I go, okay, like there's the peace that I would expect, like what I would expect peace to feel like. I usually feel that when I've left a room and I knew, and that was right. But like entering a room maybe is a totally different thing for me. If I'm like going somewhere new or trying something new, or I've said yes to something, or I'm, you know, making a big decision in my life or something, it never feels like, you know, a hot shower or a hug from my dad or like cool sheets at the end of a long day. Like it never feels like that. It feels like my insides are on fire. And so I just have always found like, we need to find a different word for this, or we need to redefine peace or something, because...
Right. Because I think that's it. And I don't think either one of us are saying peace doesn't matter. I think what we're saying is peace might not feel like we think it feels.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's the difference.
Yeah.
And I would say it takes a lot of practice to begin to identify peace, a feeling of peace in our own bodies. And so if our bodies are betraying us with a feeling of peace, I think it's important to rely on some other data points in those situations. We don't only have to go on. I think it's a very important data point. Our bodies, our feelings, also our thinking mind, also the people who love us, also time and prayer. Like there's a lot of data points that we can look at if we have the luxury of time and being able to kind of take that time that we have. We don't always have that luxury, but I think that's something important to pay attention to.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like that. Can you talk about the difference between readiness and timeliness?
You know, when it comes to discerning whether or not it's time to stay or time to walk away, that is the type of decision, the type of ending that is a discerned ending. But there are other kinds of endings that we haven't really talked about. And one is a forced ending when you want it to stay, but someone else decided it's time for you to go. Or you showed up and told the truth and got yourself kicked right out of that room. And that happens sometimes too. And so this is an ending that might require a different type of processing, but there's no discernment necessarily needed. The discernment comes in the processing and in the closure or the lack of, but the decision was made for you. Mm-hmm. Another type of ending that we kind of alluded to already was the anticipated endings. And these are your graduations, births, maybe someone has a diagnosis and you know that the end is near. These are the retirements. A lot of these tend to be celebratory. And we have, at least here in our Western culture and most cultures all around the world, we have our cultural norms and our communal ways of marking anticipated endings. We have graduations, weddings, baby showers, wedding showers, all the type of celebrations that we do. And those anticipated endings are often easier to process because we all agree together, this is what's happening. I would say those anticipated endings, for the most part, are when readiness and timeliness align. We've decided, I'm ready to get married, and we've decided to get married, and it's time to get married, and here we are, and that's a wonderfully celebratory moment when readiness and timeliness come together. But when it comes to these discerned endings, these are the ones where we are always kind of, we probably don't realize we're doing this, but I'm trying to put language to something that we're all experiencing, but maybe don't talk about. And that is that we're always kind of evaluating, what is my readiness level and what is the timeliness level? And we're trying to get them to line up. Mm-hmm. And the problem is sometimes we're waiting for that piece, the decision to be right, because we're waiting for me feeling ready and it being time to be perfectly aligned. And the reality is, sometimes you are deeply ready and it is not time. And this is an opportunity for us to cultivate patience. Other times, it is time and we are not ready. I think of Lorne Michaels at Saturday Night Live. Tina Fey writes about how he famously said that Saturday Night Live does not go on because it's ready. It goes on because it's 11:30 on a Saturday night. It goes on the air because it's time. Could those creators have worked another week on that? Yes, they could have, and they could have made it better. It didn't matter though, because the time had come, even though they weren't ready. And I think we can all point to those. And so that's kind of why I wanted to write a whole book about it, was because we don't really need a whole book about anticipated endings. And I think we need maybe half a book about forced ones. But it's that process of us having to make a call when we don't feel ready or it doesn't seem time. What do we do then? And so that's a conversation I think is really important to talk about.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. That's so good. You talk about naming your guideposts in order to determine what matters to you. What are, like, tell us what that is. What are guideposts and how do we figure out what we want those to be? I want to say really quick though, I love the fact that you've put language to all these things because you're exactly right. Like, we know what this feels like, but we don't know how to talk about it because it's almost like no one has ever sat with this long enough to identify the steps of what's happening. And so I love that you, thank you for doing that.
Well, you're welcome. You know, we often, we do the thing that we need the most. And for me, the last 4 years has been a process of leaving and entering a lot of rooms. And so I found myself needing to write my way through it. And in reflection, write my way through it. And I say this in the acknowledgments of the book, but this was one of those books, and maybe all books are like this, but I've not experienced it quite this acutely with my other writing, that wanted to be written in a very specific time period. And I think if I would have waited a month or two longer, I don't know that I could have started it. And I don't think I could write this book now. I think it was just the right time, and maybe almost a little bit late than what I needed to do. And so I'm grateful that I was able to get it down in before it disappeared. So I will say that. But you asked, what did you ask? You did ask an actual question.
I did. But actually, I mean, can you tell us a little bit more about the rooms? Like, whatever you're willing to share, whatever you feel comfortable sharing about some of the rooms that you've been walking into and walking out of in the last 4 years.
Yeah, there's been big rooms and there's been small rooms. I think one of the biggest, and I tell more of this story in the book writing, but one of the biggest was we discerned in 2020 that it was the time had come for us to leave our church where we thought we would be forever. And through a series of different circumstances and things going on in our own life, as well as things going on in the world, and just in our own community, we just discerned, using kind of the framework in this book that I named after the fact, but at the time didn't have, but was doing it anyway, discerned that. And let me tell you what, for us, our church community was where we gave, this is where we offered our time, our money, our gifting. This is where we found our community, where we served. I mean, it was the spoke in the wheel of our lives around which everything revolved. And maybe not specifically this church, but every church we'd been part of had been this way. My husband's a pastor. And so first 12 years of our marriage, he was on staff at a church. And then the next 7 years after that, we were at this small church where we thought we'd be forever. And within about a year's time, we realized like, that's not going to be the case. And let me tell you what, when you begin to change your mind on something, whether it's about a space or community or whatever, you don't I think we forget, or maybe we know this, and this is why we don't change our minds. The loneliness on the other side of it that is hard to articulate. And to be honest with you, still hasn't gone away. Even though we have found community, we have a lot of the same friends, I'm still in a relationship with many people at our former church who I love dearly, and they have stayed there. They're still there. Their own discernment processes determined that they needed to stay. And we are still in relationship, and I'm so grateful for that. But there's still a sense of, there's been an overhaul, I guess, if you will, of recognizing how deeply connected I was to that particular community, and to reconcile with that understanding, and to reconcile that with my current reality, and wondering, well, what does it mean about me? Am I a leaver? Not only did I take an action, but does this say something about who I am? And I think, much like you had mentioned your narratives about being a stayer, that you weren't just saying, I am a person who takes the action of staying. You were saying, I am a stayer. It's part of my identity. Mm-hmm. And so what about when you do something that feels like it's determining a part of your identity? Like, well, what is that? What now? What am I left with now? And so that's one room that has been, you know, as you can imagine, if I've articulated it at all, I don't know. It's not just one thing you leave. There are so many secondary. I mean, I know when you lose a spouse, I've heard, I have a friend who lost her husband, and she talks a lot about the secondary losses, that everybody knows you lost your person, but a lot of people don't realize all the other losses that also come along with that big loss that we name. There's so many other losses that go unnamed and unrecognized, and in many ways, unwitnessed. And so maybe there's something in me that wanted to bear witness to my own loss in this book, and not just my own story, but hopefully, I think this is true in writing, that the more specific we are, sometimes the more broadly it applies. And so I tried to be as specific as I was able to be while still honoring the stories that aren't mine to tell, so that those who read can maybe see themselves and their own stories reflected, even if church isn't your thing. It doesn't have to be church, but I think we understand what it is to belong, and then to willingly walk away from that belonging, or to have that belonging taken away from you. I think we all understand what that feels like. And so that's what I tried to articulate in writing through this.
Yeah.